Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Stephen.
And I'm Anoush.
And as you will have noticed, that is not Helen Lewis, who's with me in our podcast catacomb this week. Helen is away, and so Anoush Kalin, our deputy web editor, has stepped ably into her place in a big and exciting week in Westminster and beyond. Ian Duncan Smith has resigned. Ian Duncan Smith has resigned. There's not a problem with the podcast, I just wanted to say it twice. And he's caused a sort of mini crisis in the Conservative Party, hasn't he?
Yes, so it was massive, shocking news on Friday night when all of a sudden the Work and Pension Secretary, who somehow managed to hang on to his job in Cabinet despite basically doing nothing but all of the things that he has done being either extremely damaging to government finances or to people's lives, suddenly resigned. And the reason for his resignation, what he said, was that he just couldn't stay on in his job with any conscience and carry on with the government's plans for further cuts to disability benefits, the PIP. But lots of journalists and commentators and other politicians decided that this wasn't necessarily his only reason for resigning, or even his actual reason for resigning, citing reasons like Brexit, fallouts with other people in the cabinet, George Osborne, and that kind of thing.
Yeah. You have probably spent more time on IDS and the consequences of these 6 years of power than probably anyone on staff, including you went back to Easterhouse, which is where he says he had this epiphany, which is what led to his first for welfare reform. What was it actually like there?
Yes, well, back when he was Tory leader, he went to visit this big estate, big, very poor, deprived estate in Glasgow called Easterhouse. And it was cited as his epiphany because he was sort of photographed close to tears. And then he started his compassionate conservatism project, in inverted commas, by the way, listeners. And so I went back to visit last year, I think, or maybe even earlier this year, I can't remember, to see how his policies as Work and Pensions Secretary had actually affected the people who need government support the most. And it was, I mean, I don't want to paint the place as completely bleak because it's unfair on the people who live there because he was the one who made it a byword for poverty. But speaking to the people there who have to survive on benefits, their lives had definitely been made worse by the last 5 or 6 years of government welfare cuts. So one of the main problems was that it's so much easier to get your benefits sanctioned now than it was before, for minor transgressions, but also for things that are beyond your control. For example, if you are actually working and you can't go to the job centre that day, or you have a long way to travel and you don't have the bus fare, you can't afford it. I mean, that's the point. You're supposed to be getting state help if you don't have enough money, but people are getting punished because they don't have enough money. And so they have their benefits taken away, which makes it extremely difficult for them to survive, but also means that some of them are pushed to do things that they don't necessarily want to. Like, I met a man who had been arrested because he'd got into a fight. And, you know, all of these things, your life and your social standing begin to break down the moment that the state takes away its help.
The fallout from that, as well as the U-turn on the PIP cuts, has left the government with this $4 billion hole, which obviously isn't very large in terms of the amount of money the government spends. It's created a political problem for them, and it further busts Osborne's kind of austerity narrative. Wow, it's much harder to be in the Helen role where you actually have to move things on and not just make silly jokes every 5 minutes or so. But Don't tell her I said that, listeners. the pressure on the government's kind of eased now, hasn't it, because of this list thing.
The list, Jeremy Corbyn's list.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is classic Labour. The moment the government is in crisis and it looks like, you know, David Cameron's cabinet is going to eat itself alive, Jeremy Corbyn pops up and does something even worse than that everyone then concentrates on. He's managed to do it this week by a list from his office being leaked somehow to the media, which is basically a friends and foes list. It's a bit like the kind of list that you would make in school, like when you're about 13, of your crushes and their pros and cons. So it's a list of MPs and it's got all these different categories. So, I mean, what was one of them? Core,
so it starts
core
with,
negative.
It's core, which is kind of your Diane Abbott, John Trickett, loyalists of that kind. Then there's core plus, which is sort of people who are not necessarily in the inner tent, but they are people who are regarded as being on sides. Like, there are some slightly mystifying people in there who certainly have not been saying very nice things to me about how things are going on. And then there's neutral but hostile.
Which
I actually think neutral but hostile seemed mostly, I mean, there was so Mike Gapes, who's obviously gone on Twitter and is not a Jeremy fan at all, is in neutral but hostile. Neutral but hostile, and then there's negative core, or and then there's hostile.
Yes.
And hostile, weirdly, includes Ed Miliband and Rosie Winterton, the chief whip. And of course, this is kind of, it's normal behaviour for a leader in a parliamentary democracy to have a list of this kind. Under Blair, the category that one of the political sects had in his or her head, I can't now remember which one of the many poll sects I've been talking to about this story, said they had embittered sacked. But they said, but the thing you don't do is you don't write it down in a copy which you take with you, because it appears in the Times, Deputy Editor Sam Coates found it in a bar in the House of Commons because it's been left there.
Right, okay, yeah, that's, I mean, that's Corbyn style of politics, isn't it? I've heard that in previous governments, maybe Tony Blair's, but I'm not sure, that they used to write it on a whiteboard so they could immediately wipe it off. So yeah, I mean, I don't blame him for making the list, but also the fact that it leaked, and also the fact that the fact that the list itself is not very accurate is also quite hilarious. So you've got, you mentioned a few, but there's, I think, Catherine McKinnell's on there, who resigned because she said that the Labour Party was going down a negative path and she could no longer stay in the shadow cabinet. I think she's in neutral.
Yeah.
And so it's quite funny that even when they make these lists that are supposed to be super secret, they can't even get that right.
Yeah. Although whiteboards aren't all they're cracked up to be necessarily. Okay. Greg Pope, who was a whip, no, who was a junior minister, lost his job because during a reshuffle they did it all with post-it notes on a reshuffle, and his post-it fell during the reshuffle, and so he ended up not being, because when you move something, you go, oh, we need to move them back. His post-it fell, another job wasn't found for him. 2 days later, one of the whips found his post-it note on the floor in the office. So
he's literally not a footnote of New Labour history, he's a forgotten post-it note of New Labour history.
Yes, indeed. And on that note, we'll be back next week.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman, Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now let's go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So the talk at Westminster today is a list revealed in the Times today, apparently prepared by Jeremy Corbyn's office, ranking Labour MPs according to their favourability towards Corbyn. So you've got a sort of core loyal group of 19, you've got a neutral group, you've got a hostile group, you've got a negative group. And at first, some Labour MPs couldn't believe that such a list existed. I think in the Times story, one is quoted as saying the lesson from Richard Nixon is never make a list of your enemies, because there's a good chance that they'll discover it. This list apparently was left in a Commons bar. That seems to be the most likely explanation. So which in some ways is so cock up rather than conspiracy, which is better for Jeremy Corbyn's team than having someone who is leaking something so embarrassing from the inside. But what was also interesting and embarrassing about the list is how misplaced some MPs were. So Mike Gapes, who has been one of the most vocal Corbyn critics right from the start, was placed in the neutral category and promptly tweeted this morning that I'm not neutral about anything.
Brilliant. What have other MPs been saying about the list? Obviously, John Woodcock sent a tweet that I realised we're probably not allowed to read out because it would jeopardise our podcast's U rating. But he had a reaction to the list which was fairly off colour, which I'm sure our listeners can imagine themselves. But what are other people saying about it?
So Chukwuemeka told me that I think he was placed in the hostile category or the negative one. And he said, I've been working hard to win elections for Labour. I've consistently voted with the whip, and I've accepted an offer to work on Labour's relationship with the BME community. And this is an attempt to divide Labour. It undermines our unity against the Conservatives. So I think there are MPs here, but this is symptomatic of the mindset that Jeremy Corbyn's office have of Labour MPs, which is that they're out to get them. Corbyn allies would no doubt respond that they have good reason to be paranoid, and some MPs really are after them. After all, a lot of MPs have told me recently, and others, that they hope to launch a challenge after the EU referendum. So it's not odd or foolish at all for Corbyn's camp to be making calculations how many MPs support they have. The problem is that it's come to light, and also that some of the calculations are flat out wrong.
Yeah. Do you buy this? There's a conspiracy theory going around that Jeremy Corbyn's team leaked it deliberately to show that they have the numbers to get him on the ballot and resist a coup attempt. Does that feel plausible to you?
I don't think so, because I think MPs are already broadly aware of who might be prepared to nominate Corbyn again or nominate a successor. And I don't think Corbyn's office is quite that devious and Machiavellian. If you look over the last few months, there have been plenty of cock-ups and not many conspiracies, which is what makes the list and the fact that it's came to light entirely plausible. I don't think it's a strategic manoeuvre by them.
So there is lots of talk of a, rightly or wrongly, of a coup attempt. Do you think that this talk makes that more or less likely, or keeps the chances of it exactly the same?
I don't think it has a significant effect either way, but I think it will further turn MPs against him. I mean, one noted to me during PMQs that Jeremy Corbyn didn't defend Rosie Winterton, the highly respected chief whip, when David Cameron joked about her being in the hostile category. A lot of Labour MPs feel that Jeremy Corbyn doesn't realise how lucky he is to have Rosie Winterton, who's experienced and who's often said, along with Chris Bryant, the shadow leader of the Commons, to have kept Labour on the road in parliamentary terms. So I think this will further harm Corbyn, and obviously has harmed relations between MPs and his office. I think the other thing which will harm Corbyn this week is his failure to exploit the opportunities presented by the Conservatives split and Ian Duncan-Smith's resignation. So astonishingly, in his response to David Cameron on Monday in the House of Commons, he failed to mention Ian Duncan-Smith. It was left to Liz Kendall and the backbenchers to essentially make the point, even IDS thinks you're too right-wing now. He tried to make it at Prime Minister's questions, but it felt rather after the event, given that the government's now ruled out further welfare cuts, the budget has passed, the Brussels attacks have taken the focus off Ian Duncan-Smith. It did feel like someone trying to score open goals that they missed after the whistle had blown, sort of just hoping to have the feeling of kicking the ball into the back of the net, even though it's out of time. And then, of course, David Cameron had this gift of this list and deployed it to good effect. And as he mocked the categories Labour MPs were put into, on the Labour side, they pointed at their Tory opponents, mocking the fact that many of them want David Cameron gone and want out of the EU. But Jeremy Corbyn wasn't able to exploit that at all. He could have said, I draw up a list of the Tory factions opposed to the Prime Minister, but it would take too long. Instead, he just sort of pleaded with David Cameron to end the theatre. And his supporters, of course, will say he's trying to change politics, he's trying to play a different game. The problem is he hasn't really been successful at changing the game. So there were some who thought when he adopted his own style of PMQs that it would cause problems for David Cameron. But it hasn't really. And there's not much evidence at the moment that that the Tories, for all their failures, are really going to lose any sleep on Labour.
And on that cheery note, Iros, you won't be back next week because you're off on holiday. Have a lovely time, etc., etc. But we will be back next week for more joy. Hey.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And now it seems barely a week goes by without some new controversy in our universities, whether it's safe spaces or no platforms, or indeed recently allegations of anti-Semitism in the Oxford University Labour Club. We're joined by Henry Zeppman, your first time on the podcast.
Very happy to be here.
You don't look very happy, but maybe you will be.
No, this is my happy face.
As our kind of representative, now that I'm afraid, Stephen, there, you're too old to have an opinion on this, but you are our representative of a recent graduate who therefore is presumed to have some insight. You wrote a piece for the magazine about what happened at Oxford's Labour Club. Can you just tell us a bit more about that and why we should care, really?
Sure. Well, I was co-chair of the Oxford University Labour Club the start of 2014, the blissful time when we were just over a year away from Ed Miliband's inevitable government. And I am also Jewish, or Jew-ish, as I like to say. And I never encountered any real palpable anti-Semitism. But a few weeks ago, Alex Chalmers, who was co-chair, mm-hmm. same role I'd held, resigned, saying that there was a climate of anti-Israel discourse in the Labour Club, which had, in many instances, gone far further than that and become simple anti-Semitism. Why I think Labour should care? Well, two reasons. The first is that these people did not become anti-Semites in a vacuum. They are part of a broader climate of discourse on the left, but also, in some cases, on the left of the Labour Party, and, in fact, the mainstream of the Labour Party. And the second is, quite simply, without sounding self-aggrandizing, because I have no ambitions in this regard, a lot of people who run the Oxford University Labour Club and are prominent in it end up running the country, or, you know, failing to run the country, as former co-chair Ed Miliband.
No, I think that's really interesting, because we've covered this a little bit in online. Stephen, you have to say, you rein me back on this one, don't you? I mean, you say that this is kind of, our over-scrutiny of what happens in universities can sometimes be a bit odd.
I take the view that student politics should be scrutinised by student journalists in student papers. And also, I mean, I suppose I'm going to sound like a lot like Boris Johnson now, but I think Cicero can teach us something here. Cicero once wrote, "Times are bad, children disobey their parents, and everybody is writing a book." And he wrote that,
O tempora, o mores? Is that the original Latin of it?
Yeah.
I'm sure people will write in if it's not. So basically it's that thing that students have always been lazy and ill-thinking.
And everyone believes their own times to be uniquely depraved. I agree with Henry that there is something I have noticed as I've covered the Labour Party, is a growing anti-Semitism becoming mainstream.
I was really surprised to hear this word "Zio," which is like some contraction of Zionist, and I had already known that, you know, that Zionist was a word that, it was one of those words like immigrant that had an originally useful meaning and is now kind of completely, it's one of those red flag words that
Absolutely.
You kind of go, oh, hang, where's this one going? But I mean, had you ever heard that word?
Yes, but not ever used by people who were in the Labour mainstream, and that's what was so shocking about it. I mean, the word Zionist increasingly is used as a code word for Jew, but, you know, has a tradition as a perfectly useful, in fact, a term that people who are Jewish or, you know, pro-Israel would happily use to describe themselves. But now it's often used either as a code word or pejoratively. But the case of the contraction Zio, it is unambiguously a pejorative. And so the fact that it's being used, as Alex Chalmers alleges, with frequency by people who are very active in the Labour Party is concerning.
I think there is a real difference because difficulty here because I saw that Hugo Rifkind, who is a Times columnist, posted about this, I think. Actually, and I think Owen Jones tweeted about it as well. And the response instantly was, actually, it's not anti-Semitic to criticise Israel.
Yeah.
And that, again, is one of those sort of weird things where you go, well, no, it's not. Why are you bringing that up?
Exactly. The response is always, no one said that it was always anti-Semitic to criticise Israel. As Nick Cohen has been pointing out for years, well over a decade, and he has some, I think, a reasonable claim to have been prophetic in this regard. Increasingly, people who are anti-Semites use the idea that people are saying that it's always anti-Semitic to criticise Israel as cover for their anti-Semitic criticisms of Israel. And I think that's an important point which can't be stated too often.
I think that's also important because there is a huge amount of criticism of Israel. Actually, I'm sure the magazine mentions it a couple of times, this fantastic 20,000 word piece about, you know, Obama and his relationship. And he talks about his relationship with Netanyahu in terms of immense frustration. And some of the policies that that recent Israeli governments have passed have been, you know, incredibly discriminatory and offensive. But he's done it in a way of which there is absolutely no hint that there is any kind of sense that he thinks there's some sort of world conspiracy or, you know, bags of gold or any of the kind of strange tropes that kind of keep. Henry, I want to ask you, my thesis has always been, in my day, I was in university 2001 to 2004, we had tuition fees were just coming in. There was the Iraq War, which was a massive, massive thing for all student activists.
What colour was the TV then, Grandad?
We only had five channels. I'm just putting that out there. It felt as though actually there we were fighting the man more than we were fighting each other. But have students got kind of more this sort of Stepford student thesis? I know, sure. Brendan, have they got more totalitarian, more intolerant of dissent, more prone to wars, or are we just noticing it more because they're all tweeting angrily?
I mean, the probably the awkward answer is I don't know. I certainly think that I don't think it's true that there weren't big things that my student generation was dealing with. I mean, I was the first year who was charged £9,000 rather than £3,000 tuition fees. And, plenty of people were pretty angry about that. Mm. But yes, I think you're certainly right that a lot of the disputes at the moment seem to be internal within the student movement. By the way, I mean, I don't always think that's a bad thing. Far from it. I think certainly I and lots of other people have become far more aware of the various privileges that some groups enjoy and some marginalised groups don't enjoy. And the importance of, an intersectional approach to issues of injustice. And I think that's really salutary and good. The other thing that I'm always reminded of is that as frustrating and mad as many of the things that the National Union of Students does at the moment, and it's worth remembering that almost every student knows nothing and pays no attention to anything that they do, which is part of the reason they have the license to do these things. But the NUS was run by communists for a decade, not so long ago. Communists who are mostly now Blairites, by the way. Students were never, Peter Mandelson, former communist, was not a fully formed Blairite as a young man. Mm. Alan Milburn ran a radical bookshop called Days of Hope, or Haze of Dope, as it became colloquially known, and then ended up, introducing or hastening the introduction of marketization into the health service. So, I wouldn't be too wary that everyone from my generation is going to remain.
No, Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail, has a thing, because he was a left-wing student.
Sure.
You know, if you're not left-wing at 20, you have no heart. If you're still left-wing at 40, you have no head. Or I might be slightly misquoting him then, but the premise is that everybody, no matter how far they travel right over their lives, flirts with being leftier than they are as a student. I just think there's one of the things that I think is a really interesting strain that maybe we should come back to later is the feminist society's attitudes towards Islamic societies. And I think it's very interesting that you see feminist societies that are usually so attentive to, like you say, intersectional issues around race and gender, don't have a lot of criticism for actually borderline Islamist, Islamic extremist preachers who probably aren't that LGBT friendly. Strangely, in that sense, in those, they often seem to kind of get a pass on that.
But equally, the cruel reality of and I'm getting to the age where this is already starting to play itself out, many of the people in those societies will suddenly turn a blind eye to sending their children to single-sex schools as well. They will decide that actually...
Well, no, I think it's really funny that you see that, you know, all these terrifying things about labour meetings segregated and stuff like that from people who sent their kids to Eton or, you know, or single-sex schools. Actually, sometimes, you know, and as a feminist, there are very good reasons for single-sex spaces, not least, and people should be allowed to, in my opinion, self-organise how they want to. But for public meetings, it's slightly different. But yeah, I suppose as soon as you say, and it's Muslims doing it, people kind of go, freak out.
I think it's the very attentiveness towards intersectionality which sometimes leads to these funny and, I think, often accidental double standards. So witness, for example, the NUS, there was a motion in 2014 petitioning that it, some sort of one of its many organs, condemn ISIS. Pretty uncontroversial, you might think. Now, some bigwigs in the NUS said, well, actually, that might be construed as Islamophobic, and therefore the motion fell, and they decided that they couldn't, as an organisation, condemn ISIS. Now, obviously, that is ludicrous, but it comes from a sort of, it comes from a good place. That good place has been contorted. I'm not defending it at all. I'm just sort of charting its origin. It isn't a load of people sat in a room saying, well, I have sympathy with ISIS.
I bloody love ISIS.
It's a load of people sat in a room trying to do a good thing and making themselves do ridiculous things in the process. Now, I think it is unambiguously ridiculous that they couldn't find it in themselves to condemn ISIS. But I think to understand the genesis of those kinds of weird stories, which are, you know, 300 words on page 4 of the Daily Mail, there's a much longer story of attempts to be intersectional, which are prima facie laudable, which end up contorted out of all reasonableness.
Well, that's it. We sorted out students and we're against them.
Public health.
Yeah, thank you very much, Henry, for joining us.
Thank you.
And now a section called You Ask Us. What have people asked us this week, Stephen?
Well, we have a question from Katie Lee, which, introduced it saying, oh, I'm worried it's a stupid question, but I think it's a very good question, which actually goes to the heart of a lot of what happened in the summer to the Labour Party and why some people acted in the way they did. Why did Labour never refer to the small Tory majority post-election? You'd think they'd won a landslide. Obviously, they only have a majority of 12.
Well, I think, and I'm aware that I'm cribbing this from George previously, but I think it's a case of direction of travel. And I think it's partly down to the fact that it was so unexpected. I think because we had so much discussion, and this kind of goes to the heart of the conversation about why polling is, you know, is interesting, but it also by its very nature changes the result, that it's kind of, you know, I think it's the Hawthorne effect, you know, you change stuff by observing it. And because we had all this kind of conjecture about a Labour SNP deal, that then as soon as there was a Tory majority, no one had sort of had anything prepped for that. So that seemed like a really stunning win. Whereas if he'd gone down from having a majority of 40 to a majority, well, effectively he did, because he had the Lib Dems, he had a majority of 60. So David Cameron effectively went down from a majority of 60 to one of 12. And if it had been presented that way, it would have been really much more seen as this is a kind of wing and a prayer government.
I think you're exactly right. It was the surprise. It's also for geeks like me who obsess over individual seats, though there are now basically only 23 seats that we would usually think of as marginals that Labour would hope to win very easily.
Are those all Labour Tory marginals?
That 2,000 vote margin. There's only one which is not, and it is Nick Clegg in Sheffield Hallam, where Labour came a fairly close second.
Because there were whispers, you know, is Nick Clegg going to lose his seat? And then someone said to me not long after the vote, I bet Nick Clegg wishes that he had lost his seat, because now he's got to haunt Westminster for 5 years.
Yeah, because they can't afford or risk a by-election. And so he's kind of stuck there. I also think, and the reason why I think it's important to how people behaved in the summer, for a lot of people at the top of the Labour Party, they woke up under the coalition, one, believing they'd get back into office soon, because of the polls, but also they knew at least one, that most people knew at least one Lib Dem through maybe a campaign to keep Britain in Europe or through the Euro, something for electoral reform. And so they always had this idea of, oh, there might be something we can defeat the government on. There might be. And then suddenly, even though it's got a smaller majority, the issues on which they can go, oh, we can try and force a U-turn here, that has got much smaller. So the opposition, particularly in Parliament, feels a lot weaker, because they don't think they can beat them as much as they
I also think that one of the reasons that that's been reinforced, that we haven't ended up feeling that the government's majority was really small is that the majority of their defeats have been characterised by such unrest in their own ranks. I mean, inevitably with an overall majority, but tax credits was preceded, you know, that U-turn was preceded by, you know, a massive swelling of angst on the Tory benches, and then actually a defeat in the Lords where they don't have a majority. This is another thing I guess people don't talk about enough. I had Baroness Hollis on Week in Westminster when I was presenting that, and she said, you know, the Tories are really angry because for the first time in ever, they've been in government without a majority in the Lords because we've taken out all the hereditary peers. But they should do what I had to do when I was a government minister, which was they had to go and convince people in the Lords who are crossbenchers to vote for you. And they just assume that there should be a permanent Tory majority in the Lords because they were used to that pre-1997. And I think that's another factor that we don't talk about enough. One of the things that's characterised this Parliament so far is stuff being ping-ponged back from the Lords. I think, in fact, a Tory peer is standing up today to talk about defeating some of the stuff about short money and about the trade union funding. Yeah. So actually, you've ended up with some interesting positions being taken by people on the Tory side. And that's why... Also, I think we've been focusing on that really big split in Europe, which is 100 MPs. So actually, you almost begin, when you think of Tory splits, you don't begin to think of them as parliamentary majorities. You think of them as splits over the EU.
Yeah.
Well, that's I wasn't a stupid question at all. And, you know, I really love stupid questions because I feel like often what happens is people don't ask what they feel is a question that everyone else knows the answer to. And it turns out that's not the case. It's just that...
And I think we definitely did over the summer talk ourselves into this because the defeat was... so unexpected for most people, and its scale was then, you know, and then it sort of got to that point towards the end of the leadership election. People started going, yeah, they only have a majority of 12. They are beatable. They're not as Corinthian as they appear. And it did, I think, contribute to a mood of fatalism. I mean, also the fact the other three candidates weren't very good. But I think one of the advantages Corbyn had was, one, he was the best candidate in terms of how he ran his campaign. And also there was a feeling of despair around the
Yeah, I think it was a feeling that, candidate. You know, we should have had this election. We thought, we banked it, we thought we had it in some form or other, even if it was a deal with the Lib Dems or the Scottish Nationalists or whoever, we thought we had it. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Book, and our music is Devil with a Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.